Arawan, or Over the Range. Chapter 1, Wastelands. If the reader will excuse me, I will say nothing of my antecedents, nor of the circumstances which led me to leave my native country. The narrative would be tedious to him and painful to myself. Suffice it, that when I left home it was with the intention of going to some new colony, and either finding, or even perhaps purchasing, waste crown land suitable for cattle or sheep farming, by which means I thought that I could better my fortunes more rapidly than in England. It will be seen that I did not succeed in my design, and that however much I may have met with that was new and strange, I have been unable to reap any pecuniary advantage. It is true, I imagine myself to have made a discovery which, if I can be the first to profit by it, will bring me a recompense beyond all money computation, and secure me a position such as has not been attained by more than some 15 or 16 persons, since the creation of the universe. But to this end I must possess myself of a considerable sum of money, neither do I know how to get it, except by interesting the public in my story, and inducing the charitable to come forward and assist me. With this hope I now publish my adventures, but I do so with great reluctance, for I fear that my story will be doubted unless I tell the whole of it, and yet I dare not do so, lest others with more means than mine should get the start of me. I prefer the risk of being doubted to that of being anticipated, and have therefore concealed my destination on leaving England, as also the point from which I began my more serious and difficult journey. My chief consolation lies in the fact that truth bears its own impress, and that my story will carry conviction by reason of the internal evidences for its accuracy. No one who is himself honest will doubt my being so. I reached my destination in one of the last months of 1868, but I dare not mention the season, lest the reader should gather in which hemisphere I was. The colony was one which had not been opened up even to the most adventurous settlers for more than 8 or 9 years, having been previously uninhabited, save by a few tribes of savages who frequented the seaboard. The part known to Europeans consisted of a coastline about 800 miles in length, affording 3 or 4 good harbors, and a tract of country extending inland for a space varying from 200 to 300 miles, until it reached the offshoots of an exceedingly lofty range of mountains, which could be seen from far out upon the plains, and were covered with perpetual snow. The coast was perfectly well known both north and south of the tract to which I have alluded, but in neither direction was there a single harbor for 500 miles, and the mountains, which descended almost into the sea, were covered with thick timber, so that none would think of settling. With this bay of land, however, the case was different. The harbors were sufficient, the country was timbered, but not too heavily, it was admirably suited for agriculture, it also contained millions on millions of acres of the most beautifully grassed country in the world, and of the best suited for all manner of sheep and cattle. The climate was temperate, and very healthy, there were no wild animals, nor were the natives dangerous, being few in number and of an intelligent tractable disposition. It may be readily understood that when once Europeans set foot upon this territory they were not slow to take advantage of its capabilities. Sheep and cattle were introduced, and bred with extreme rapidity, men took up their 50,000 or 100,000 acres of country, going inland one behind the other, till in a few years there was not an acre between the sea and the front ranges which was not taken up, and stations either for sheep or cattle were spotted about at intervals of some 20 or 30 miles over the whole country. The front ranges stopped the tide of squatters for some little time, it was thought that there was too much snow upon them for too many months in the year, that the sheep would get lost, the ground being too difficult for shepherding, that the expense of getting wool down to the ship's side would eat up the farmers' profits, and that the grass was too rough and sour for sheep to thrive upon. But one after another determined to try the experiment, and it was wonderful how successfully it turned out. Men pushed farther and farther into the mountains, and found a very considerable tract inside the front range, between it and another which was loftier still, though even this was not the highest, the great snowy one which could be seen from out upon the plains. This second range, however, seemed to mark the extreme limits of pastoral country, and it was here, at a small and newly founded station, that I was received as a cadet, and soon regularly employed. I was then just 22 years old. I was delighted with the country and the manner of life. It was my daily business to go up to the top of a certain high mountain, and down one of its spurs onto the flat, in order to make sure that no sheep had crossed their boundaries. I was to see the sheep, not necessarily close at hand, nor to get them in a single mob, but to see enough of them here and there to feel easy that nothing had gone wrong. This was no difficult matter, for there were not above 800 of them, and, being all breeding ewes, they were pretty quiet. There were a good many sheep which I knew, as 2 or 3 black ewes, and a black lamb or two, and several others which had some distinguishing mark whereby I could tell them. I would try and see all these, and if they were all there, and the mob looked large enough, I might rest assured that all was well. It is surprising how soon the eye becomes accustomed to missing 20 sheep out of 200 or 300. I had a telescope and a dog, and would take bread and meat and tobacco with me. Starting with early dawn, it would be night before I could complete my round, for the mountain over which I had to go was very high. In winter it was covered with snow, and the sheep needed no watching from above. If I were to see sheep dung or tracks going down onto the other side of the mountain, where there was a valley with a stream, a mere cul-de-sac, I was to follow them, and look out for sheep, but I never saw any, the sheep always descending onto their own side, partly from habit, and partly because there was abundance of good sweet feed, which had been burned in the early spring, just before I came, and was now deliciously green and rich, while that on the other side had never been burnt, and was rank and coarse. It was a monotonous life, but it was very healthy, and one does not much mind anything when one is well. The country was the grandest that can be imagined. How often have I sat on the mountainside and watched the waving downs, with the two white specks of huts in the distance, and the little square of garden behind them, the paddock with a patch of bright green oats above the huts, and the yards and wool sheds down on the flat below, all seen as through the wrong end of a telescope, so clear and brilliant was the air, or as upon a colossal model or map spread out beneath me. Beyond the downs was a plain, going down to a river of great size, on the farther side of which there were other high mountains, with the winter snow still not quite melted. Up the river, which ran winding in many streams over a bed some 2 miles broad, I looked upon the second great chain, and could see a narrow gorge where the river retired and was lost. I knew that there was a range still farther back, but except from one place near the very top of my own mountain, no part of it was visible. From this point, however, I saw, whenever there were no clouds, a single snow-clad peak, many miles away, and I should think about as high as any mountain in the world. Never shall I forget the utter loneliness of the prospect, only the little faraway homestead giving sign of human handiwork, the vastness of mountain and plain, of river and sky, the marvelous atmospheric effects, sometimes black mountains against a white sky, and then again, after cold weather, white mountains against a black sky, sometimes seen through breaks and swirls of cloud, and sometimes, which was best of all, I went up my mountain in a fog, and then got above the mist, going higher and higher, I would look down upon a sea of whiteness, through which would be thrust innumerable mountain tops that looked like islands. I am there now, as I write, I fancy that I can see the downs, the huts, the plain, and the riverbed, that torrent pathway of desolation, with its distant roar of waters. Oh, wonderful! Wonderful! So lonely and so solemn, with the sad gray clouds above, and no sound save a lost lamb bleating upon the mountain side, as though its little heart were breaking. Then there comes some lean and withered old ewe, with deep gruff voice and unlovely aspect, trotting back from the seductive pasture. Now she examines this gully, and now that, and now she stands listening with uplifted head, that she may hear the distant wailing and obey it. Aha! They see, and rush towards each other. Alas! They are both mistaken, the ewe is not the lamb's ewe, they are neither kin nor kind to one another, and part in coldness. Each must cry louder, and wander farther yet, may luck be with them both that they may find their own at nightfall. But this is mere dreaming, and I must proceed. I could not help speculating upon what might lie farther up the river and behind the second range. I had no money, but if I could only find workable country, I might stock it with borrowed capital, and consider myself a made man. True, the range looked so vast, that there seemed little chance of getting a sufficient road through it or over it, but no one had yet explored it, and it is wonderful how one finds that one can make a path into all sorts of places, and even get a road for pack horses, which from a distance appear inaccessible. The river was so great that it must drain an inner tract, at least I thought so, and though everyone said it would be madness to attempt taking sheep farther inland, I knew that only 3 years ago the same cry had been raised against the country which my master's flock was now overrunning. I could not keep these thoughts out of my head as I would rest myself upon the mountain side. They haunted me as I went my daily rounds, and grew upon me from hour to hour, till I resolved that after shearing I would remain in doubt no longer, but saddle my horse, take as much provision with me as I could, and go and see for myself. But over and above these thoughts came that of the great range itself. What was beyond it? Ah! Who could say? There was no one in the whole world who had the smallest idea, save those who were themselves on the other side of it, if, indeed, there was any one at all. Could I hope to cross it? This would be the highest triumph that I could wish for, but it was too much to think of yet. I would try the nearer range, and see how far I could go. Even if I did not find country, might I not find gold, or diamonds, or copper, or silver? I would sometimes lie flat down to drink out of a stream, and could see little yellow specks among the sand. Were these gold? People said no, but then people always said there was no gold until it was found to be abundant. There was plenty of slate and granite, which I had always understood to accompany gold, and even though it was not found in paying quantities here, it might be abundant in the main ranges. These thoughts filled my head, and I could not banish them. Chapter 2, In the Wool Shed. At last shearing came, and with the shearers there was an old native, whom they had nicknamed Chowbokto, I believe. His real name was Kahabuka. He was a sort of chief of the natives, could speak a little English, and was a great favorite with the missionaries. He did not do any regular work with the shearers, but pretended to help in the yards, his real aim being to get the grog, which is always more freely circulated at shearing time. He did not get much, for he was apt to be dangerous when drunk, and very little would make him so. Still, he did get it occasionally, and if one wanted to get anything out of him, it was the best bribe to offer him. I resolved to question him, and get as much information from him as I could. I did so. As long as I kept to questions about the nearer ranges, he was easy to get on with. He had never been there, but there were traditions among his tribe to the effect that there was no sheep country, nothing, in fact, but stunted timber and a few riverbed flats. It was very difficult to reach, still there were passes, one of them up our own river, though not directly along the riverbed, the gorge of which was not practicable. He had never seen anyone who had been there. Was there to not enough on this side? But when I came to the main range, his manner changed at once. He became uneasy, and began to prevaricate and shuffle. In a very few minutes I could see that of this too there existed traditions in his tribe, but no efforts or coaxing could get a word from him about them. At last I hinted about grog, and presently he feigned consent. I gave it him, but as soon as he had drunk it he began shamming intoxication, and then went to sleep, or pretended to do so, letting me kick him pretty hard and never budging. I was angry, for I had to go without my own grog and had got nothing out of him, so the next day I determined that he should tell me before I gave him any, or get none at all. Accordingly, when night came and the shearers had knocked off work and had their supper, I got my share of rum in a tin pannikin and made a sign to Chowbok to follow me to the wool shed, which he willingly did, slipping out after me, and no one taking any notice of either of us. When we got down to the wool shed we lit a tallow candle, and having stuck it in an old bottle we sat down upon the wool bales and began to smoke. A wool shed is a roomy place, built somewhat on the same plan as a cathedral, with aisles on either side full of pens for the sheep, a great nave, at the upper end of which the shearers work, and a further space for wool sorters and packers. It always refreshed me with a semblance of antiquity, precious in a new country, though I very well knew that the oldest wool shed in the settlement was not more than 7 years old, while this was only 2. Chowbok pretended to expect his grog at once, though we both of us knew very well what the other was after, and that we were each playing against the other, the one for grog, the other for information. We had a hard fight. For more than 2 hours he had tried to put me off with lies but had carried no conviction. During the whole time we had been morally wrestling with one another and had neither of us apparently gained the least advantage. At length, however, I had become sure that he would give in ultimately, and that with a little further patience I should get his story out of him. As upon a cold day in winter, when one has churned, as I had often had to do, and churned in vain, and the butter makes no sign of coming, at last one tells by the sound that the cream has gone to sleep, and then upon a sudden the butter comes, so I had churned at Chowbok until I perceived that he had arrived, as it were, at the sleepy stage, and that with a continuance of steady quiet pressure the day was mine. On a sudden, without a word of warning, he rolled 2 bales of wool, his strength was very great, into the middle of the floor, and on the top of these he placed another crosswise. He snatched up an empty wool pack, threw it like a mantle over his shoulders, jumped upon the uppermost bale, and sat upon it. In a moment his whole form was changed. His high shoulders dropped, he set his feet close together, heel to heel and toe to toe, he laid his arms and hands close alongside of his body, the palms following his thighs. He held his head high but quite straight, and his eyes stared right in front of him, but he frowned horribly, and assumed an expression of face that was positively fiendish. At the best of times Chowbok was very ugly, but he now exceeded all conceivable limits of the hideous. His mouth extended almost from ear to ear, grinning horribly and showing all his teeth, his eyes glared, though they remained quite fixed, and his forehead was contracted with a most malevolent scowl. I am afraid my description will have conveyed only the ridiculous side of his appearance, but the ridiculous and the sublime are near, and the grotesque fiendishness of Chowbok's face approached this last, if it did not reach it. I tried to be amused, but I felt a sort of creeping at the roots of my hair and over my whole body, as I looked and wondered what he could possibly be intending to signify. He continued thus for about a minute, sitting bolt upright, as stiff as a stone, and making this fearful face. Then there came from his lips a low moaning like the wind, rising and falling by infinitely small gradations till it became almost a shriek, from which it descended and died away. After that, he jumped down from the bale and held up the extended fingers of both his hands, as one who should say 10, though I did not then understand him. For myself I was open-mouthed with astonishment. Chowbok rolled the bales rapidly into their place, and stood before me shuddering as in great fear. Horror was written upon his face this time quite involuntarily, as though the natural panic of one who had committed an awful crime against unknown and superhuman agencies. He nodded his head and gibbered, and pointed repeatedly to the mountains. He would not touch the grog, but, after a few seconds he made a run through the woolshed door into the moonlight, nor did he reappear till next day at dinner time, when he turned up, looking very sheepish and abject in his civility towards myself. Of his meaning I had no conception. How could I? All I could feel sure of was, that he had a meaning which was true and awful to himself. It was enough for me that I believed him to have given me the best he had and all he had. This kindled my imagination more than if he had told me intelligible stories by the hour together. I knew not what the great snowy ranges might conceal, but I could no longer doubt that it would be something well worth discovering. I kept aloof from Chowbok for the next few days, and showed no desire to question him further. When I spoke to him I called him Kahabuka, which gratified him greatly. He seemed to have become afraid of me, and acted as one who was in my power. Having therefore made up my mind that I would begin exploring as soon as shearing was over, I thought it would be a good thing to take Chowbok with me, so I told him that I meant going to the nearer ranges for a few days prospecting, and that he was to come too. I made him promises of nightly grog, and held out the chances of finding gold. I said nothing about the main range, for I knew it would frighten him. I would get him as far up our own river as I could, and trace it if possible to its source. I would then either go on by myself, if I felt my courage equal to the attempt, or return with Chowbok. So, as soon as ever shearing was over and the wool sent off, I asked leave of absence, and obtained it. Also, I bought an old pack horse and pack saddle, so that I might take plenty of provisions, and blankets, and a small tent. I was to ride and find fords over the river, Chowbok was to follow and lead the pack horse, which would also carry him over the fords. My master let me have tea and sugar, ship's biscuits, tobacco, and salt mutton, with two or three bottles of good brandy, for, as the wool was now sent down, abundance of provisions would come up with the empty drays. Everything being now ready, all the hands on the station turned out to see us off, and we started on our journey, not very long after the summer solstice of 1870. Chapter 3, Up the River. The first day we had an easy time, following up the great flats by the riverside, which had already been twice burned, so that there was no dense undergrowth to check us, though the ground was often rough, and we had to go a good deal upon the riverbed. Towards nightfall we had made a matter of some 5 and 20 miles, and camped at the point where the river entered upon the gorge. The weather was delightfully warm, considering that the valley in which we were encamped must have been at least 2,000 feet above the level of the sea. The riverbed was here about a mile and a half broad and entirely covered with shingle, over which the river ran in many winding channels, looking, when seen from above, like a tangled skein of ribbon, and glistening in the sun. We knew that it was liable to very sudden and heavy freshets, but even had we not known it, we could have seen it by the snags of trees, which must have been carried long distances, and by the mass of vegetable and mineral debris which was banked against their lower side, showing that at times the whole riverbed must be covered with a roaring torrent many feet in depth and of ungovernable fury. At present the river was low, there being but 5 or 6 streams, too deep and rapid for even a strong man to ford on foot, but to be crossed safely on horseback. On either side of it there were still a few acres of flat, which grew wider and wider down the river, till they became the large plains on which we looked from my master's hut. Behind us rose the lowest spurs of the second range, leading abruptly to the range itself, and at a distance of 1/2 mile began the gorge, where the river narrowed and became boisterous and terrible. The beauty of the scene cannot be conveyed in language. The one side of the valley was blue with evening shadow, through which loomed forest and precipice, hillside and mountain top, and the other was still brilliant with the sunset gold. The wide and wasteful river with its ceaseless rushing, the beautiful water birds too, which abounded upon the islets and were so tame that we could come close up to them, the ineffable purity of the air, the solemn peacefulness of the untrodden region, could there be a more delightful and exhilarating combination? We set about making our camp, close to some large bush which came down from the mountains onto the flat, and tethered out our horses upon ground as free as we could find it from anything round which they might wind the rope and get themselves tied up. We dared not let them run loose, lest they might stray down the river home again. We then gathered wood and lit the fire. We filled a tin pannikin with water and set it against the hot ashes to boil. When the water boiled, we threw in 2 or 3 large pinches of tea and let them brew. We had caught 6 young ducks in the course of the Dionysi matter, for the old birds made such a fuss in attempting to decoy us away from them, pretending to be badly hurt, as they say the plover does, that we could always find them by going about in the opposite direction to the old bird till we heard the young ones crying. Then we ran them down, for they could not fly though they were nearly full grown. Chowbok plucked them a little and singed them a good deal. Then we cut them up and boiled them in another pannikin, and this completed our preparations. When we had done supper, it was quite dark. The silence and freshness of the night, the occasional sharp cry of the woodhen, the ruddy glow of the fire, the subdued rushing of the river, the somber forest, and the immediate foreground of our saddles, packs and blankets, made a picture worthy of a Salvator Rosa or a Nicolas Poussin. I call it to mind and delight in it now, but I did not notice it at the time. We next to never know when we are well off, but this cuts two ways, for if we did, we should perhaps know better when we are ill off also, and I have sometimes thought that there are as many ignorant of the one as of the other. He who wrote, "O fortunatos nimium suisse bona norint agricolis," might have written quite as truly, "O infortunatos nimium suisse mala norint," and there are few of us who are not protected from the keenest pain by our inability to see what it is that we have done, what we are suffering, and what we truly are. Let us be grateful to the mirror for revealing to us our appearance only. We found as soft a piece of ground as we could, though it was all stony, and having collected grass and so disposed of ourselves that we had a little hollow for our hip bones, we strapped our blankets around us and went to sleep. Waking in the night, I saw the stars overhead and the moonlight bright upon the mountains. The river was ever rushing. I heard one of our horses neigh to its companion, and was assured that they were still at hand. I had no care of mind or body, save that I had doubtless many difficulties to overcome. There came upon me a delicious sense of peace, a fullness of contentment which I do not believe can be felt by any but those who have spent days consecutively on horseback, or at any rate in the open air. Next morning we found our last night's tea leaves frozen at the bottom of the pannikins. Though it was not nearly the beginning of autumn, we breakfasted as we had supped, and were on our way by 6 o'clock. In 30 minutes we had entered the gorge, and turning round a corner we bade farewell to the last sight of my master's country. The gorge was narrow and precipitous. The river was now only a few yards wide, and roared and thundered against rocks of many tons in weight. The sound was deafening, for there was a great volume of water. We were 2 hours in making less than a mile, and that with danger, sometimes in the river and sometimes on the rock. There was that damp black smell of rocks covered with slimy vegetation, as near some huge waterfall where spray is ever rising. The air was clammy and cold. I cannot conceive how our horses managed to keep their footing, especially the one with the pack, and I dreaded the having to return almost as much as going forward. I suppose this lasted 3 miles, but it was well midday when the gorge got a little wider, and a small stream came into it from a tributary valley. Farther progress up the main river was impossible, for the cliffs descended like walls, so we went up the side stream, Chowbok seeming to think that here must be the pass of which reports existed among his people. We now incurred less of actual danger but more fatigue, and it was only after infinite trouble, owing to the rocks and tangled vegetation, that we got ourselves and our horses upon the saddle from which this small stream descended. By that time clouds had descended upon us, and it was raining heavily. Moreover, it was 6 o'clock and we were tired out, having made perhaps 6 miles in 12 hours. On the saddle there was some coarse grass which was in full seed, and therefore very nourishing for the horses, also abundance of annas and sow thistle, of which they are extravagantly fond, so we turned them loose and prepared to camp. Everything was soaking wet and we were half perished with cold. Indeed, we were very uncomfortable. There was brushwood about, but we could get no fire till we had shaved off the wet outside of some dead branches and filled our pockets with the dry inside chips. Having done this, we managed to start a fire, nor did we allow it to go out when we had once started it. We pitched the tent and by 9 o'clock were comparatively warm and dry. Next morning it was fine. We broke camp, and after advancing a short distance we found that, by descending over ground less difficult than yesterday's, we should come again upon the riverbed, which had opened out above the gorge, but it was plain at a glance that there was no available sheep country, nothing but a few flats covered with scrub on either side the river, and mountains which were perfectly worthless. But we could see the main range. There was no mistake about this. The glaciers were tumbling down the mountain sides like cataracts, and seemed actually to descend upon the riverbed. There could be no serious difficulty in reaching them by following up the river, which was wide and open, but it seemed rather an objectless thing to do, for the main range looked hopeless, and my curiosity about the nature of the country above the gorge was now quite satisfied. There was no money in it whatever, unless there should be minerals, of which I saw no more signs than lower down. However, I resolved that I would follow the river up, and not return until I was compelled to do so. I would go up every branch as far as I could, and wash well for gold. Chow Bok liked seeing me do this, but it never came to anything, for we did not even find the color. His dislike of the main range appeared to have worn off, and he made no objections to approaching it. I think he thought there was no danger of my trying to cross it, and he was not afraid of anything on this side. Besides, we might find gold. But the fact was that he had made up his mind what to do if he saw me getting too near it. We passed 3 weeks in exploring, and never did I find time go more quickly. The weather was fine, though the nights got very cold. We followed every stream but one, and always found it lead us to a glacier which was plainly impassable, at any rate without a larger party and ropes. One stream remained, which I should have followed up already, had not Chow Bok said that he had risen early one morning while I was yet asleep, and after going up it for 3 or 4 miles, had seen that it was impossible to go farther. I had long ago discovered that he was a great liar, so I was bent on going up myself. In brief, I did so. So far from being impossible, it was quite easy traveling, and after 5 or 6 miles I saw a saddle at the end of it, which, though covered deep in snow, was not glaciered, and which did verily appear to be part of the main range itself. No words can express the intensity of my delight. My blood was all on fire with hope and elation, but on looking round for Chow Bok, who was behind me, I saw to my surprise and anger that he had turned back, and was going down the valley as hard as he could. He had left me. Chapter 4, The Saddle. I cooed to him, but he would not hear. I ran after him, but he had got too good a start. Then I sat down on a stone and thought the matter carefully over. It was plain that Chow Bok had designedly attempted to keep me from going up this valley, yet he had shown no unwillingness to follow me anywhere else. What could this mean, unless that I was now upon the route by which alone the mysteries of the great ranges could be revealed? What then should I do? Go back at the very moment when it had become plain that I was on the right scent? Hardly, yet to proceed alone would be both difficult and dangerous. It would be bad enough to return to my master's run, and pass through the rocky gorges, with no chance of help from another should I get into a difficulty, but to advance for any considerable distance without a companion would be next door to madness. Accidents which are slight when there is another at hand, as the spraining of an ankle, or the falling into some place whence escape would be easy by means of an outstretched hand and a bit of rope, may be fatal to one who is alone. The more I pondered the less I liked it, and yet, the less could I make up my mind to return when I looked at the saddle at the head of the valley, and noted the comparative ease with which its smooth sweep of snow might be surmounted. I seemed to see my way almost from my present position to the very top. After much thought, I resolved to go forward until I should come to some place which was really dangerous, but then to return. I should thus, I hoped, at any rate reach the top of the saddle, and satisfy myself as to what might be on the other side. I had no time to lose, for it was now between 10 and 11 in the morning. Fortunately I was well equipped, for on leaving the camp and the horses at the lower end of the valley I had provided myself, according to my custom, with everything that I was likely to want for 4 or 5 days. Chow Bok had carried half, but had dropped his whole swag I suppose, at the moment of his taking flight, for I came upon it when I ran after him. I had, therefore, his provisions as well as my own. Accordingly, I took as many biscuits as I thought I could carry, and also some tobacco, tea, and a few matches. I rolled all these things, together with a flask nearly full of brandy, which I had kept in my pocket for fear lest Chow Bok should get hold of it, inside my blankets, and strapped them very tightly, making the whole into a long roll of some 7 feet in length and 6 inches in diameter. Then I tied the two ends together, and put the whole round my neck and over one shoulder. This is the easiest way of carrying a heavy swag, for one can rest oneself by shifting the burden from one shoulder to the other. I strapped my pannikin and a small axe about my waist, and thus equipped began to ascend the valley, angry at having been misled by Chow Bok, but determined not to return till I was compelled to do so. I crossed and recrossed the stream several times without difficulty, for there were many good fords. At 1 o'clock I was at the foot of the saddle. For 4 hours I mounted, the last 2 on the snow, where the going was easier. By 5, I was within 10 minutes of the top, in a state of excitement greater, I think, than I had ever known before. 10 minutes more, and the cold air from the other side came rushing upon me. A glance. I was not on the main range. Another glance. There was an awful river, muddy and horribly angry, roaring over an immense riverbed, thousands of feet below me. It went round to the westward, and I could see no farther up the valley, save that there were enormous glaciers which must extend round the source of the river, and from which it must spring. Another glance, and then I remained motionless. There was an easy pass in the mountains directly opposite to me, through which I caught a glimpse of an immeasurable extent of blue and distant plains. Easy? Yes, perfectly easy, grass nearly to the summit, which was, as it were, an open path between two glaciers, from which an inconsiderable stream came tumbling down over rough but very possible hillsides, till it got down to the level of the great river, and formed a flat where there was grass and a small bush of stunted timber. Almost before I could believe my eyes, a cloud had come up from the valley on the other side, and the plains were hidden. What wonderful luck was mine! Had I arrived 5 minutes later, the cloud would have been over the pass, and I should not have known of its existence. Now that the cloud was there, I began to doubt my memory, and to be uncertain whether it had been more than a blue line of distant vapor that had filled up the opening. I could only be certain of this much, namely, that the river in the valley below must be the one next to the northward of that which flowed past my master's station. Of this there could be no doubt. Could I, however, imagine that my luck should have led me up a wrong river in search of a pass, and yet brought me to the spot where I could detect the one weak place in the fortifications of a more northern basin? This was too improbable. But even as I doubted, there came a rent in the cloud opposite, and a second time I saw blue lines of heaving downs, growing gradually fainter, and retiring into a far space of plain. It was substantial, there had been no mistake whatsoever. I had hardly made myself perfectly sure of this, ere the rent in the clouds joined up again and I could see nothing more. What, then, should I do? The night would be upon me shortly, and I was already chilled with standing still after the exertion of climbing. To stay where I was would be impossible. I must either go backwards or forwards. I found a rock which gave me shelter from the evening wind, and took a good pull at the brandy flask, which immediately warmed and encouraged me. I asked myself, could I descend upon the riverbed beneath me? It was impossible to say what precipices might prevent my doing so. If I were on the riverbed, dare I cross the river? I am an excellent swimmer, yet, once in that frightful rush of waters, I should be hurled whithersoever it willed, absolutely powerless. Moreover, there was my swag. I should perish of cold and hunger if I left it, but I should certainly be drowned if I attempted to carry it across the river. These were serious considerations, but the hope of finding an immense tract of available sheep country, which I was determined that I would monopolize as far as I possibly could, sufficed to outweigh them, and, in a few minutes, I felt resolved that, having made so important a discovery as a pass into a country which was probably as valuable as that on our own side of the ranges, I would follow it up and ascertain its value, even though I should pay the penalty of failure with life itself. The more I thought, the more determined I became either to win fame and perhaps fortune, by entering upon this unknown world, or give up life in the attempt. In fact, I felt that life would be no longer valuable if I were to have seen so great a prize and refused to grasp at the possible profits therefrom. I had still an hour of good daylight during which I might begin my descent onto some suitable camping ground, but there was not a moment to be lost. At first I got along rapidly, for I was on the snow, and sank into it enough to save me from falling, though I went forward straight down the mountainside as fast as I could, but there was less snow on this side than on the other, and I had soon done with it, getting onto a coombe of dangerous and very stony ground, where a slip might have given me a disastrous fall. But I was careful with all my speed, and got safely to the bottom, where there were patches of coarse grass, and an attempt here and there at brushwood. What was below this I could not see. I advanced a few hundred yards farther, and found that I was on the brink of a frightful precipice, which no one in his senses would attempt ascending. I bethought me, however, to try the creek which drained the coombe, and see whether it might not have made itself a smoother way. In a few minutes I found myself at the upper end of the chasm in the rocks, something like TWLL do, only on a greatly larger scale. The creek had found its way into it, and had worn a deep channel through a material which appeared softer than that upon the other side of the mountain. I believe it must have been a different geological formation, though I regret to say that I cannot tell what it was. I looked at this rift in great doubt, then I went a little way on either side of it, and found myself looking over the edge of horrible precipices onto the river, which roared some 4,000 or 5,000 feet below me. I dared not think of getting down at all, unless I committed myself to the rift, of which I was hopeful when I reflected that the rock was soft, and that the water might have worn its channel tolerably evenly through the whole extent. The darkness was increasing with every minute, but I should have twilight for another half hour, so I went into the chasm, though by no means without fear, and resolved to return and camp, and try some other path next day, should I come to any serious difficulty. In about 5 minutes I had completely lost my head, The side of the rift became hundreds of feet in height, and overhung so that I could not see the sky. It was full of rocks, and I had many falls and bruises. I was wet through from falling into the water, of which there was no great volume, but it had such force that I could do nothing against it. Once I had to leap down a not inconsiderable waterfall into a deep pool below, and my swag was so heavy that I was very nearly drowned. I had indeed a hair's breadth escape, but, as luck would have it, Providence was on my side. Shortly afterwards I began to fancy that the rift was getting wider, and that there was more brushwood. Presently I found myself on an open grassy slope, and feeling my way a little farther along the stream, I came upon a flat place with wood, where I could camp comfortably, which was well, for it was now quite dark. My first care was for my matches. Were they dry? The outside of my swag had got completely wet, but, on undoing the blankets, I found things warm and dry within. How thankful I was! I lit a fire, and was grateful for its warmth and company. I made myself some tea and ate two of my biscuits. My brandy I did not touch, for I had little left, and might want it when my courage failed me. All that I did almost mechanically, for I could not realize my situation to myself, beyond knowing that I was alone, and that return through the chasm which I had just descended would be impossible. It is a dreadful feeling, that of being cut off from all one's kind. I was still full of hope, and built golden castles for myself as soon as I was warmed with food and fire, but I do not believe that any man could long retain his reason in such solitude, unless he had the companionship of animals. One begins doubting one's own identity. I remember deriving comfort even from the sight of my blankets, and the sound of my watch ticking things which seemed to link me to other people, but the screaming of the wood hens frightened me, as also a chattering bird which I had never heard before, and which seemed to laugh at me, though I soon got used to it, and before long could fancy that it was many years since I had first heard it. I took off my clothes, and wrapped my inside blanket about me, till my things were dry. The night was very still, and I made a roaring fire, so I soon got warm, and at last could put my clothes on again. Then I strapped my blanket round me, and went to sleep as near the fire as I could. I dreamed that there was an organ placed in my master's wool shed. The wool shed faded away, and the organ seemed to grow and grow amid a blaze of brilliant light, till it became like a golden city upon the side of a mountain, with rows upon rows of pipes set in cliffs and precipices, one above the other, and in mysterious caverns, like that of Fingal, within whose depths I could see the burnished pillars gleaming. In the front there was a flight of lofty terraces, at the top of which I could see a man with his head buried forward towards a keyboard, and his body swaying from side to side amid the storm of huge arpeggioed harmonies that came crashing overhead and round. Then there was one who touched me on the shoulder, and said, "Do you not see? It is Handel." But I had hardly apprehended, and was trying to scale the terraces, and get near him, when I awoke, dazzled with the vividness and distinctness of the dream. A piece of wood had burned through, and the ends had fallen into the ashes with a blaze. This, I supposed, had both given me my dream and robbed me of it. I was bitterly disappointed, and sitting up on my elbow, came back to reality and my strange surroundings as best I could. I was thoroughly aroused. Moreover, I felt a foreshadowing as though my attention were arrested by something more than a dream, although no sense in particular was as yet appealed to. I held my breath and waited, and then I heard. Was it fancy? Nay, I listened again and again, and I did hear a faint and extremely distant sound of music, like that of an Aeolian harp, borne upon the wind which was blowing fresh and chill from the opposite mountains. The roots of my hair thrilled. I listened, but the wind had died, and, fancying that it must have been the wind itself, no, on a sudden I remembered the noise which Chowbok had made in the wool shed. Yes, it was that. Thank heaven, whatever it was over now. I reasoned with myself, and recovered my firmness. I became convinced that I had only been dreaming more vividly than usual. Soon I began even to laugh, and think what a fool I was to be frightened at nothing, reminding myself that even if I were to come to a bad end it would be no such dreadful matter after all. I said my prayers, a duty which I had too often neglected, and in a little time fell into a really refreshing sleep, which lasted till broad daylight, and restored me. I rose, and searching among the embers of my fire, I found a few live coals and soon had a blaze again. I got breakfast, and was delighted to have the company of several small birds, which hopped about me and perched on my boots and hands. I felt comparatively happy, but I can assure the reader that I had had a far worse time of it than I have told him, and I strongly recommend him to remain in Europe if he can, or, at any rate, in some country which has been explored and settled, rather than go into places where others have not been before him. Exploring is delightful to look forward to and back upon, but but it is not comfortable at the time, unless it be of such an easy nature as not to deserve the name. Chapter 5, The River and the Range. My next business was to descend upon the river. I had lost sight of the pass which I had seen from the saddle, but had made such notes of it that I could not fail to find it. I was bruised and stiff, and my boots had begun to give, for I had been going on rough ground for more than 3 weeks, but, as the day wore on, and I found myself descending without serious difficulty, I became easier. In a couple of hours I got among pine forests where there was little undergrowth, and descended quickly till I reached the edge of another precipice, which gave me a great deal of trouble, though I eventually managed to avoid it. By about 3 or 4 o'clock I found myself on the riverbed. From calculations which I made as to the height of the valley on the other side the saddle over which I had come, I concluded that the saddle itself could not be less than 9,000 feet high, and I should think that the riverbed, onto which I now descended, was 3,000 feet above the sea level. The water had a terrific current, with a fall of not less than 40 to 50 feet per mile. It was certainly the river next to the northward of that which flowed past my master's run, and would have to go through an impassable gorge, as is commonly the case with the rivers of that country, before it came upon known parts. It was reckoned to be nearly 2,000 feet above the sea level where it came out of the gorge onto the plains. As soon as I got to the riverside I liked it even less than I thought I should. It was muddy, being near its parent glaciers. The stream was wide, rapid, and rough, and I could hear the smaller stones knocking against each other under the rage of the waters, as upon a seashore. Fording was out of the question. I could not swim and carry my swag, and I dared not leave my swag behind me. My only chance was to make a small raft, and that would be difficult to make, and not at all safe when it was made, not for one man in such a current. As it was too late to do much that afternoon, I spent the rest of it in going up and down the riverside, and seeing where I should find the most favorable crossing. Then I camped early, and had a quiet comfortable night with no more music, for which I was thankful, as it had haunted me all day, although I perfectly well knew that it had been nothing but my own fancy, brought on by the reminiscence of what I had heard from Chowbok and by the overexcitement of the preceding evening. Next day I began gathering the dry bloom stalks of a kind of flag or iris-looking plant, which was abundant, and whose leaves, when torn into strips, were as strong as the strongest string. I brought them to the waterside, and fell to making myself a kind of rough platform, which should suffice for myself and my swag if I could only stick to it. The stalks were 10 or 12 feet long, and very strong, but light and hollow. I made my raft entirely of them, binding bundles of them at right angles to each other, neatly and strongly, with strips from the leaves of the same plant, and tying other rods across. It took me all day till nearly 4 o'clock to finish the raft, but I had still enough daylight for crossing, and resolved on doing so at once. I had selected a place where the river was broad and comparatively still, some 70 or 80 yards above a furious rapid. At this spot I had built my raft. I launched it, made my swag fast to the middle, and got onto it myself, keeping in my hand one of the longest blossom stalks, so that I might punt myself across as long as the water was shallow enough to let me do so. I got on pretty well for 20 or 30 yards from the shore, but even in this short space I nearly upset my raft by shifting too rapidly from one side to the other. The water then became much deeper, and I leaned over so far in order to get the bloom rod to the bottom that I had to stay still, leaning on the rod for a few seconds. Then, when I lifted up the rod from the ground, the current was too much for me and I found myself being carried down the rapid. Everything in a second flew past me, and I had no more control over the raft, neither can I remember anything except hurry, and noise, and waters which in the end upset me. But it all came right, and I found myself near the shore, not more than up to my knees in water and pulling my raft to land, fortunately upon the left bank of the river, which was the one I wanted. When I had landed I found that I was about a mile, or perhaps a little less, below the point from which I started. My swag was wet upon the outside, and I was myself dripping, but I had gained my point, and knew that my difficulties were for a time over. I then lit my fire and dried myself, having done so I caught some of the young ducks and seagulls, which were abundant on and near the riverbed, so that I had not only a good meal, of which I was in great want, having had an insufficient diet from the time that Chowbok left me, but was also well provided for the morrow. I thought of Chowbok, and felt how useful he had been to me, and in how many ways I was the loser by his absence, having now to do all sorts of things for myself which he had hitherto done for me, and could do infinitely better than I could. Moreover, I had set my heart upon making him a real convert to the Christian religion, which he had already embraced outwardly, though I cannot think that it had taken deep root in his impenetrably stupid nature. I used to catechize him by our campfire, and explain to him the mysteries of the Trinity and of original sin, with which I was myself familiar, having been the grandson of an archdeacon by my mother's side, to say nothing of the fact that my father was a clergyman of the English Church. I was therefore sufficiently qualified for the task, and was the more inclined to it, over and above my real desire to save the unhappy creature from an eternity of torture, by recollecting the promise of St. James, that if anyone converted a sinner, which Chowbok surely was, he should hide a multitude of sins. I reflected, therefore, that the conversion of Chowbok might in some degree compensate for irregularities and shortcomings in my own previous life, the remembrance of which had been more than once unpleasant to me during my recent experiences. Indeed, on one occasion I had even gone so far as to baptize him, as well as I could, having ascertained that he had certainly not been both christened and baptized, and gathering, from his telling me that he had received the name William from the missionary, that it was probably the first mentioned rite to which he had been subjected. I thought it great carelessness on the part of the missionary to have omitted the second, and certainly more important, ceremony which I have always understood precedes christening both in the case of infants and of adult converts, and when I thought of the risks we were both incurring I determined that there should be no further delay. Fortunately it was not yet 12 o'clock, so I baptized him at once from one of the pannikins, the only vessels I had, reverently, and, I trust, efficiently. I then set myself to work to instruct him in the deeper mysteries of our belief, and to make him, not only in name, but in heart a Christian. It is true that I might not have succeeded, for Chowbok was very hard to teach. Indeed, on the evening of the same day that I baptized him he tried for the 20th time to steal the brandy, which made me rather unhappy as to whether I could have baptized him rightly. He had a prayer book more than 20 years old which had been given him by the missionaries, but the only thing in it which had taken any living hold upon him was the title of Adelaide the Queen Dowager, which he would repeat whenever strongly moved or touched, and which did really seem to have some deep spiritual significance to him, though he could never completely separate her individuality from that of Mary Magdalene, whose name had also fascinated him, though in a less degree. He was indeed stony ground, but by digging about him I might have at any rate deprived him of all faith in the religion of his tribe, which would have been halfway towards making him a sincere Christian, and now all this was cut off from me, and I could neither be of further spiritual assistance to him nor he of bodily profit to myself. Besides, any company was better than being quite alone. I got very melancholy as these reflections crossed me, but when I had boiled the ducks and eaten them I was much better. I had a little tea left and about a pound of tobacco, which should last me for another fortnight with moderate smoking. I had also 8 ship biscuits, and, most precious of all, about 6 ounces of brandy, which I presently reduced to 4, for the night was cold. I rose with early dawn, and in an hour I was on my way, feeling strange, not to say weak, from the burden of solitude, but full of hope when I considered how many dangers I had overcome, and that this day should see me at the summit of the dividing range. After a slow but steady climb of between 3 and 4 hours, during which I met with no serious hindrance, I found myself upon a tableland, and close to a glacier which I recognized as marking the summit of the pass. Above it towered a succession of rugged precipices and snowy mountain sides. The solitude was greater than I could bear. The mountain upon my master's sheep run was a crowded thoroughfare in comparison with his somber, sullen place. The air, moreover, was dark and heavy, which made the loneliness even more oppressive. There was an inky gloom over all that was not covered with snow and ice. Grass there was none. Each moment I felt increasing upon me the dreadful doubt as to my own identity, as to the continuity of my past and present existence, which is the first sign of that distraction which comes on those who have lost themselves in the bush. I had fought against this feeling hitherto, and had conquered it, but the intense silence and gloom of this rocky wilderness were too much for me, and I felt that my power of collecting myself was beginning to be impaired. I rested for a little while, and then advanced over very rough ground, until I reached the lower end of the glacier. Then I saw another glacier, descending from the eastern side into a small lake. I passed along the western side of the lake, where the ground was easier, and when I had got about halfway I expected that I should see the plains which I had already seen from the opposite mountains, but it was not to be so, for the clouds rolled up to the very summit of the pass, though they did not overlip it onto the side from which I had come. I therefore soon found myself enshrouded by a cold thin vapor, which prevented my seeing more than a very few yards in front of me. Then I came upon a large patch of old snow, in which I could distinctly trace the half-melted tracks of goats, and in one place, as it seemed to me, there had been a dog following them. Had I lighted upon a land of shepherds? The ground, where not covered with snow, was so poor and stony, and there was so little herbage, that I could see no sign of a path or regular sheep track. but I could not help feeling rather uneasy as I wondered what sort of a reception I might meet with if I were to come suddenly upon inhabitants. I was thinking of this, and proceeding cautiously through the mist, when I began to fancy that I saw some objects darker than the cloud looming in front of me. A few steps brought me nearer, and a shudder of unutterable horror ran through me when I saw a circle of gigantic forms, many times higher than myself, upstanding grim and gray through the veil of cloud before me. I suppose I must have fainted, for I found myself some time afterwards sitting upon the ground, sick and deadly cold. There were the figures, quite still and silent, seen vaguely through the thick gloom, but in human shape indisputably. A sudden thought occurred to me, which would have doubtless struck me at once had I not been prepossessed with forebodings of the time that I first saw the figures, and had not the cloud concealed them from me. I mean that they were not living beings, but statues. I determined that I would count 50 slowly, and was sure that the objects were not alive if during that time I could detect no sign of motion. How thankful was I when I came to the end of my 50 and there had been no movement. I counted a second time, but again all was still. I then advanced timidly forward, and in another moment I saw that my surmise was correct. I had come upon a sort of Stonehenge of rude and barbaric figures, seated as Chowbok had sat when I questioned him in the woolshed, and with the same superhumanly malevolent expression upon their faces. They had been all seated, but two had fallen. They were barbarous, neither Egyptian, nor Assyrian, nor Japanese different from any of these, and yet akin to all. They were 6 or 7 times larger than life, of great antiquity, worn and lichen grown. They were 10 in number. There was snow upon their heads and wherever snow could lodge. Each statue had been built of 4 or 5 enormous blocks, but how these had been raised and put together is known to those alone who raised them. Each was terrible after a different kind. One was raging furiously, as in pain and great despair, another was lean and cadaverous with famine, another cruel and idiotic, but with the silliest simper that can be conceived this one had fallen, and looked exquisitely ludicrous in his fall. The mouths of all were more or less open, and as I looked at them from behind, I saw that their heads had been hollowed. I was sick and shivering with cold. Solitude had unmanned me already, and I was utterly unfit to have come upon such an assembly of fiends in such a dreadful wilderness and without preparation. I would have given everything I had in the world to have been back at my master's station, but that was not to be thought of. My head was failing, and I felt sure that I could never get back alive. Then came a gust of howling wind, accompanied with a moan from one of the statues above me. I clasped my hands in fear. I felt like a rat caught in a trap, as though I would have turned and bitten at whatever thing was nearest me. The wildness of the wind increased, the moans grew shriller, coming from several statues, and swelling into a chorus. I almost immediately knew what it was, but the sound was so unearthly that this was but little consolation. The inhuman beings into whose hearts the evil one had put it to conceive these statues, had made their heads into a sort of organ pipe, so that their mouths should catch the wind and sound with its blowing. It was horrible. However brave a man might be, he could never stand such a concert, from such lips, and in such a place. I heaped every invective upon them that my tongue could utter as I rushed away from them into the mist, and even after I had lost sight of them, and turning my head round could see nothing but the storm wraiths driving behind me, I heard their ghostly chanting, and felt as though one of them would rush after me and grip me in his hand and throttle me. I may say here that, since my return to England, I heard a friend playing some chords upon the organ which put me very forcibly in mind of the Erewhonian statues, for Erewhon is the name of the country upon which I was now entering. They rose most vividly to my recollection the moment my friend began. They are as follows, and are by the greatest of all musicians, too. Music score which cannot be reproduced. Chapter 6, Into Erewhon. And now I found myself on a narrow path which followed a small watercourse. I was too glad to have an easy track for my flight, to lay hold of the full significance of its existence. The thought, however, soon presented itself to me that I must be in an inhabited country, but one which was yet unknown. What, then, was to be my fate at the hands of its inhabitants? Should I be taken and offered up as a burnt offering to those hideous guardians of the pass? It might be so. I shuddered at the thought, yet the horrors of solitude had now fairly possessed me, and so dazed was I, and chilled, and woebegone, that I could lay hold of no idea firmly amid the crowd of fancies that kept wandering in upon my brain. I hurried onward down, down, down. More streams came in, then there was a bridge, a few pine logs thrown over the water, but they gave me comfort, for savages do not make bridges. Then I had a treat such as I can never convey on paper. A moment, perhaps, the most striking and unexpected in my whole life, the one I think that, with some 3 or 4 exceptions, I would most gladly have again, were I able to recall it. I got below the level of the clouds, Into a burst of brilliant evening sunshine, I was facing the northwest, and the sun was full upon me. Oh, how its light cheered me! But what I saw! It was such an expanse as was revealed to Moses when he stood upon the summit of Mount Sinai, and beheld that promised land which it was not to be his to enter. The beautiful sunset sky was crimson and gold, blue, silver, and purple, exquisite and tranquilizing. Fading away therein were plains, on which I could see many a town and city, with buildings that had lofty steeples and rounded domes. Nearer beneath me lay ridge behind ridge, outline behind outline, sunlight behind shadow, and shadow behind sunlight, gully and serrated ravine. I saw large pine forests, and the glitter of a noble river winding its way upon the plains, also many villages and hamlets, some of them quite near at hand, and it was on these that I pondered most. I sank upon the ground at the foot of a large tree and thought what I had best do, but I could not collect myself. I was quite tired out, and presently, feeling warmed by the sun, and quieted, I fell off into a profound sleep. I was awoke by the sound of tinkling bells, and looking up, I saw four or five goats feeding near me. As soon as I moved, the creatures turned their heads towards me with an expression of infinite wonder. They did not run away, but stood stock still, and looked at me from every side, as I at them. Then came the sound of chattering and laughter, and there approached two lovely girls, of about 17 or 18 years old, dressed each in a sort of linen gabardine, with a girdle round the waist. They saw me. I sat quite still and looked at them, dazzled with their extreme beauty. For a moment they looked at me and at each other in great amazement, then they gave a little frightened cry and ran off as hard as they could. "So that's that," said I to myself, as I watched them scampering. I knew that I had better stay where I was and meet my fate, whatever it was to be, and even if there were a better course, I had no strength left to take it. I must come into contact with the inhabitants sooner or later, and it might as well be sooner. Better not to seem afraid of them, as I should do by running away and being caught with a hue and cry tomorrow or next day. So I remained quite still and waited. In about an hour I heard distant voices talking excitedly, and in a few minutes I saw the two girls bringing up a party of 6 or 7 men, well armed with bows and arrows and pikes. There was nothing for it, so I remained sitting quite still, even after they had seen me, until they came close up. Then we all had a good look at one another. Both the girls and the men were very dark in color, but not more so than the South Italians or Spaniards. The men wore no trousers.